I'm Will Harris, and today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures.
Good morning, and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. Funny how that works. Every week it sounds kind of funny to say that. And every week at Wednesdays at 11 a.m., we talk about taste. My favorite topic, perhaps, or I guess, as I say, weekly food really is the larger topic here at heritageradionetwork.com, but everyone needs a niche, and I think mine is taste. And today we are very fortunate to be talking about the subjects of food and taste with someone with whom we could talk about just about anything in the world, it seems like sometimes, Fabio Parasecoli, who is an associate professor at the New School and the coordinator of the food studies program there. But that doesn't really say enough about you, Fabio. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You are a journalist and a scholar and a think tanker and all sorts of a person with just generally fascinating insight into food and pop culture. And so we're really happy to have you here.
Thank you.
Tell us, let's start at food and pop culture. I mean, everyone talks about food as though it's separate from pop culture, at least in this, in certain areas. But in fact, I mean, what does that even mean, food and pop culture?
That's actually a complicated question, and I've been thinking about that in a while. It's been, part of my writing and whatnot. I think of pop culture as something very broad that includes ideas, communication, media, but also practices, anything that is somehow produced, distributed, and consumed in sort of a market-oriented environment, even if it's not specifically made to be sold. I don't know, if some teenager creates a funny food video and puts it on YouTube, there is not the idea of selling anything, but at the same time, there is the idea of producing something for others to consume and to increase this consumption.
Right.
So I think lots of things fall under pop culture. In a way, it's all those sort of boiling, simmering world of videos, advertising, graphic design, films, magazines, and also restaurants and menus and chefs.
Right, and specific media and culture.
So exactly.
The Food Network is a subset, perhaps, of a niche of food, of pop culture, specific to food. So what, I mean, forget about food for a moment, what do you think, people have for a long time, and I'm sure continue today, to dismiss pop culture as being even worthy of paying any attention to. It just sort of is. And what do you think the import of pop culture is, just in general, before we get to the effect that food has within that?
I think pop culture, it's actually quite interesting because it constitutes sort of a warehouse of ideas and practices and little pieces of fantasies, desires, fears that then coagulate around different objects. So the same idea can appear, I don't know, in a poster, and then it becomes the cover of a CD, and then it becomes quoted in a video, and then it ends up in late night talk shows. I think,
which are then reported on in the New York Times,
exactly.
Where they chronicle jokes from late night TV shows, which
just
makes me laugh. Right.
That's exactly what I mean. So looking at pop culture and all the different aspects, I think it allows us to sort of get a pulse of what people are collectively thinking, or even if they're not aware that they're thinking, there are elements that are there and they are easy to reach and get in touch with. And somehow these elements emerge in the most different environments, and I think that's why it's important to look at pop culture. In a way, it's useful to go beyond the highbrow, lowbrow sort of approach to culture in this case.
Right, and just look at the environment almost of media. Interesting. So what is, I mean, food has become such an obsession here. I mean, I imagine that pop culture is regional in some sense. Obviously, it transcends region or nation or something, but in the midst of various cultures, pop culture must move, operate a little differently or distinctly. And I'm wondering, given the current fascination, the fact that you can't, you know, not even just turn on the Food Network and see a show about food 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, but you turn on a late night talk show and you see a chef, or people are constantly, you know, People Magazine is writing about chefs, and that food and food culture has become part of pop culture. What do you think that means, or what's going on there?
For me, there it's important to understand why is that happening right now. Okay. What sort of needs does this overexposure of food respond to? Why are we suddenly so interested in that? And precisely, I mean, why some buzzwords have become so important, like authentic, local, sustainable. Mm-hmm. For me, it's interesting to look at those concepts and the way they sort of pop up in different places. But above all, why now? If you look at, you know, food writing or food books from maybe 30 years ago, the concept of authentic was really not big. So for me, what's interesting is to understand, you know, what's happening in our society that create that attention. And as you said, it's, you know, it differs from place to place. So the U.S. is quite peculiar. I come from Italy. Italy is different. France is different. But at the same time, there are elements that have become global.
Right.
Precisely because food, pop culture objects travel. So, I don't know, my nephew calls me, as like, oh, I saw the last episode of MasterChef, the U.S. version. Huh. Dubbed in Italian.
And and I was just in Dubai and saw a local organic farmers market in a shopping mall in Dubai, which seemed like an out of place element of some other form of reaction and culture. You can't get away from saying you think it's really important to look at what it is means now without saying what you think it means now. Why food now? Why this obsession? What are some of your theories? Obviously, we don't have the data, perhaps.
No, yet. Exactly. Yeah. There is no data. I mean, but you know, you can reflect about, you know, but looking at what people say and how they say it and where they say it, I think there are different elements. There is, first of all, a lot of anxiety about what gets into our body. Mm-hmm. So it's a question of personal health and well-being. We want to make sure that we eat well, that the food, it's good for us. You know, there are also a lot of warnings about obesity epidemics and all sort of things. Now the sugar bottle here in New York. So all that element. But then I think that there is also the element of sort of collective health. Mm. So we start looking at local and in a way that, and sustainable, in ways that connect our personal consumption with, for instance, the future of farmland where we live, or the sustainability of our food systems. But then beyond that, there is also an element of the need to sort of anchor ourselves to some elements that gives us an identity. I mean, globalization is real. So who are we? Or how can we find real elements that we can sort of attach to and consume to make sure that we are accessing, you know, this sort of solid identity, and we're not just floating around in this sort of global soup?
The global soup, identityless soup. I love it. So we're sitting here in a restaurant in Brooklyn that has, it's Roberta's, maybe, you know, the epicenter of a movement of food in some ways. Food has been, in a certain sense, been made cool, which is another subset, perhaps, of popular culture. There's the mass, there's the whatever, and then there's the cool factor, which I know a lot of people see a lot of power in, both in terms of marketing and money, but also because if something is cool, then the kids will do it, and then you might find a lever of change somehow. Mm-hmm. Do you think, is food as cool a good thing? Is that, I mean, I know you won't want to answer good and bad, but but does making something cool, you know, help a cause, lead to some sort of change, help form an identity that you expressed we might be needing more of?
It definitely does, but at the same time, what happens to the uncool people? And who remains excluded from the coolness, and why? Those, for me, are very big questions. So, of course, you know, there is a new generation of young people, and many of them are in my classes as students, who are really invested in food systems, sustainability, and food justice, and that's great. I mean, I really appreciate all the work they do. But at the same time, you know, this element of coolness can be used as a factor of distinction. I'm cooler than somebody else. So what happens to these people who are not cool enough to have access to this sort of consumption? And not only consumption, to this new way of thinking about food. I mean, is that economics? Is that culture? Is that education? Is it environmental? Is it a mix of all that? Those are, I think, huge issues that, you know, the coolness somehow highlights.
Interesting. I want to remind our listeners that if you have any questions about coolness, maybe Fabio will be the meter and you can explain a few things and he'll tell you if you're cool or not. Or if you have questions about food and pop culture, anything, let's just say if you have questions about anything, give us a call at 718-497-2128. You can also write us an email at info@heritageradionetwork.com. Or if you're listening to a podcast or you just prefer to communicate in 140 character sentences, tweet us at Taste Matters HRN. So you have been teaching food studies, a relatively new field, although an exploding field of scholarship, and also looking at pop culture through the lens of food for some time. And I wonder if you could reflect a little bit on that and on perhaps what the study of food and food systems and food culture has done to enlighten us and possibly help, you know, to change us. I don't know.
I think, I mean, the explosion of food studies all over the country and also internationally, it's a sign of that interest towards food that we were discussing. So it's a good occasion to attract younger people into thinking in new ways about, you know, their daily lives, their choices, politics, economics. I think for that reason, food studies has developed in a very interdisciplinary way. First of all, there's the body. You know, we eat. Food becomes part of us. What does it mean in terms of how we feel about ourselves? How we live inside our bodies when we eat. There are emotional issues, there are historical issues, there are cultural issues, and then there is the whole aspect of economics and politics and the environment and communication and media. Really, food studies is sort of an umbrella definition for lots of research projects that look at different aspects of this huge reality that circulates around food. So we see programs popping up all over the country, which is great, both in the undergraduate and the graduate level. We see lots of books being published.
Indeed, amazing number of nonfiction books about food.
It's crazy, and both academic and non-academic books. It's all over the place.
Are people reading them? I wonder.
That's a good question. Will they turn into the new cookbook that you buy just, you know,
to have? Right.
And to flip through sometimes. Right. But I think also, you know, there are more and more scholars that look at food in interesting ways. Actually, next week in New York, there will be the annual conference of the Association for the Study of Food and Society. And it's really huge. I mean, I'm organizing it at the New School together with NYU. And we have already around 600 participants, 120 concurrent panels.
Oh my gosh.
It's a mammoth, and we didn't expect it. I mean, in a way, it's great because it shows how much interest there is around thinking about food.
Right.
But at the same time, what are we going to do with all those people? And how are we going to keep the momentum to actually create something that help people you know, approach food in different ways. It's a big project.
Right. And we're going to talk more about that project. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Taste Matters, and I'm talking with Fabio Parasecoli from the New School.
Fine, you girl. I got something I want to tell you.
You wait, honey. Look here.
Have you heard about that girl next door? You know, she always talking about people getting in her business.
Uh-huh.
She ain't talking about her business.
You mean to tell me she's
talking about her cooking? She's out of her kitchen. She wants you to stay out of her business.
What you say?
Walking around there with them little short coochie skirts on. Being over you.
Girl, what kind of skirts on?
Coochie skirts. coochie.
Yeah, yeah,
look at
yeah.
Mama. Let me tell you about
it. I'm not there. I live right now.
You need to shut your mouth. That's what you need to do.
Somebody tell me why everybody's in my business. Telling me what I can and cannot do. He say, he say, they say, that's what they play. When you need to be worrying about you, who are you to judge? When you hold a grudge, I get tired of hearing you talk.
White Oak Pastures is a 146-year-old multi-generational family farm that works in cooperation with nature to produce artisan meat that is safe, healthy, nutritious, and good to eat. Without fail, we ensure that our production practices are economically practical, ecologically sustainable, and that the animals are always humanely treated. We never falter in our determination to conduct our business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
Well, we're back with Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and I'm talking with Fabio Parasecoli, who is a professor at the New School and coordinator of their food studies program, and also a journalist and a coordinator of the upcoming American Society for Food and Society. No, American
Association for the Study of Food and Society.
ASFS. I've never, in years of participating in that organization, I've never known what the letters stand for. And I want to go back to something that we were talking about, and in the context of pop culture, of the study of food, and also a loss of identity. I just returned from a trip to Charleston, South Carolina, which is an exciting food destination, a place where people are really working hard to uncover historical roots and some sense of a regional identity, and looking at the agricultural history that the town has, looking at sort of what's going on around the world globally in food, and trying to forge a unique regional food culture right there in a city in America. And since you come from Italy, which is a place that has a very long tradition of regional food culture and a unique relationship, I think, to geography and identity, I just wondered, you know, what you think, how do I ask this? What insight might you have to this process of trying to find an identity in America in food? And, you know, whether it's a... I keep wanting you to make judgments that I'm sure you're uncomfortable making, but is it futile? Should we be looking at something else? Do you have any insight into whether or not New York should be finding its own cuisine, or if there's some way to evolve beyond that, mm-hmm. given your perspective from an old European established food country culture and this modern global mishmash that we are in? What's your perspective on that?
I think what's happening in the U.S. from that point of view is extremely interesting, because many people from outside the U.S. are thinking, what?
Right.
I mean, food traditions in the U.S.? But they're still there. There are remnants. There are also not remnants. I mean, living traditions that are still maintained. There are products. I think what's happening here is that people have realized that there is potential to create a sense of community around food and a sense of local identity, which I think right now it's very important for the questions of, you know, the reasons we were mentioning before, globalization and, you know, also the politics.
Internet. Yeah, the politics and the internet to me seem so important somehow.
Definitely. The whole, I mean... pop culture as a whole is moving towards some sort of attention between the attention to the extremely local and the presence of this huge global reality. And I mean, I don't look at those in opposition. I think they're actually they create each other in a way. The local is being rediscovered as a reaction to the global, maybe, but at the same time, the global is also created by the interaction of all those local realities that are there. So, you know, when people just decry globalization as the big evil, but that doesn't mean that the local is better or natural or something that it's there, it just needs to be rediscovered. The local is being built, is being reconstructed. Like, you know, in Charleston, the example you mentioned, they're looking at archaeology of agriculture. They're looking at their past. They're looking at their culinary traditions. They're looking at specific crops. But they have sort of focus on them and dig them out and reconnect them in original way. So in a way, the heritage is recreated while being rediscovered. So is the local more natural than the global or older than the global? That's quite complicated.
Of course. You're making me think of some work that you did with the EU on the appellations related to the denominations of origin and all that sort of stuff. Could you explain that process and maybe give us a cautionary tale for America where we have no such thing?
Well, in Europe, we have this big system of geographical indications. It's a particular kind of intellectual property that somehow defends food whose names are connected with a specific place. Sounds complicated, it's not. For instance, Parmigiano Reggiano. For instance, Aceto Balsamico from Modena. Here in the U.S. could be, I don't know, Vidalia onions or Vermont maple syrup.
Right.
Or, you know, that's the idea. The problem there is that a group of people at a certain point need to decide that that food deserves this sort of protection, needs to create a regulation that describes the procedures, the production, the standards, the commercialization. And at that point, it becomes political. First of all, who has the authority to decide what the authentic version of the food is?
Sort of that question, what's cool, what's not?
Exactly.
Same, who's excluded? Right?
Who's excluded in a way? So here, there are lots of questions of power. Not only that, there is also the question of who gains from making these products special, because automatically, as soon as they get a geographical indication, their prices tend to go up.
Right.
So is this increase in revenue distributed among the whole chain of production, or are there some people that have more interest in doing so? So, I mean, in a way, these denominations do help maintaining traditions and crops and products that might disappear. But at the same time, we cannot look at them as, you know, sort of objective measures. I mean, somebody decides, first of all, that the product is worth, and then they decide who makes it in the right way, and then they decide lots of things. And when there is decisions, there is politics. Yeah.
When there is decisions, there is politics. I think that should be tweeted. I think that's great, because we often think when there's people, there's politics. But actually, people wouldn't necessarily be political unless they had to decide something. Very insightful. So I'm going to run an idea by you, because one of the things that happens in that moment, in addition to the politics, is that that we find a tradition that you then fix in time things evolve, pop culture evolves, and we're always, you know, you only fix it at a certain point, and then, you know, it reminds me of immigrant culture coming to another country, as when they come, they leave. The Italians in America left at a time and sort of stayed in that time in their minds, but Italy went on and things change. And so here in this rapidly moving moment in the last few minutes we have, I wonder if you could gaze at a crystal ball, and given your global academic perspective, predict the future a little bit here in America and what you see. I mean, just based on what we've got now, where you think we're headed, because so much feels moving at the same time. You have a really large perspective. I'm just curious what you see coming, coming down.
That's a big question. I could start by saying that probably since we now food is produced and distributed and consumed and thought globally, that will be a dimension that we really need to keep in mind even when we're looking at the local. So what's the connection between, you know, this new economy of local productions and artisanal food and farm-to-fork restaurants? And how does this new economy and this new approach interact with, you know, industrial mass production of food and, you know, huge crops of corn? Right. And what's the impact of this element globally? I mean, what if this year, as it seems, the U.S. will have a bumper crop in corn? What's the impact on the corn producer in Ethiopia or the corn producer in Mexico, much closer?
Right.
And what will that mean in terms of people losing their livelihood in Mexico and maybe moving into the U.S. and creating, you know, new migrant communities that will have their own traditions and they will interact with, you know, this brave new world that's it's shaping up. I don't know. I think in my crystal ball, I think that we really need to refine our tools of analysis, and we need to start thinking in ways that really connect the local, the regional, the national, and the global in different ways, both in terms of, you know, economics, production, but in terms also of thought and culture and pop culture, you know, what people think and what they feel when they produce something or when they eat something.
Yeah, I'm going to run my idea by you because you just mentioned something that resonates with this proposal I've given to a few people. There is an organization that oversees the representation of, you know, gays and lesbians in Hollywood and television and those sorts of things. And I would like to start that organization for food. I would like to have the policing body that actually negotiates with Hollywood script writers to show how, you know, the representation of artisanal whatevers or something to ease into pop culture, not the pop culture that food people consume, mm-hmm. which is one of the hardest. I mean, that's where all the focus is. If you're already interested in reading these food things, but I actually think there's more power in the people who don't care about food at all to make some change. So maybe I'll put you on my advisory board, like a lot of other people do, for my new organization that I don't have a name for, but we're going to police pop culture food representations.
All right.
I think that's what I got out of this conversation. I think I understand your position, right? I hope you've enjoyed the half-hour conversation we've had with Fabio Parasecoli, who is the associate professor, an associate professor and the coordinator of the food studies program at New School, and who will be very busy next week with the ASFS annual conference that's here in New York. It travels around, so we're very fortunate to have 600 scholars clamoring to think deep thoughts about food. I won't even try to say what the acronym stands for. Next week, we are going to be welcoming a guest host, Karen Karp, my partner in crime. We're actually going to be conducting a meeting on sustainability and trust in the local food system in New Orleans tomorrow together. But next week, she'll be here in Brooklyn, and she'll be talking to Jane Black, who is another journalist who's been covering covered for a long time for the Washington Post the area of food and food system development, and also has been working on a really fascinating book about the town where Jamie Oliver did his the town of Virginia where he did his TV program and tried to change the cooking school, and she's gone back to sort of evaluate what's going on there and what's happened to the local food culture. So that should be a fascinating conversation. I know I'm looking forward to. I'll remind you, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.com, and every week on Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we are talking about Taste Matters with me, Mitchell Davis. In the meantime, have a good, delicious week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.